Good morning, diners, travelers, imbibers, and sweethearts.
Yeah, today's
lovers.
Today's a program for lovers in honor, of course, of the feast of Saint Valentine. We hope you're having a good time and you did all the right things, preparing gifts, making plans to have a special day on this day that's dedicated to.
To what?
what is it dedicated to?
Romance.
To? Yeah, I mean,
romance.
I don't know who Saint Valentine was, but he certainly gave rise to a frenzy, and that frenzy took Peter and Anne overseas for Valentine's Day, and we'll be telling you more about that undoubtedly in next week's program. But in the meantime, everything on theme. And one of the most fascinating things that crossed our path about Valentine's Day is a traditional Valentine's Day aphrodisiac menu created at the Carneros Bar and Grill in the beautiful town of Sonoma, California. And Chef Falvo.
Yeah, Janine Falvo. She has a good time. This is not the first year she's done this.
She has a really good time with it.
She loves it.
And you'll have a good time with it.
Did you hear that? Loves it.
Yeah, there you go. And you'll have a good time with her, too.
We're talking loves coming up, right? We're talking to Janine Falvo, Chef Janine Falvo, who has a really special interest in February 14th. She's in Sonoma, where the weather is a lot better than where we are, and she's chef of the Carneros Bistro and Wine Bar in the Renaissance Hotel. Welcome on the menu, Janine.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to talk to some people from Pittsburgh and then be international with our broadcast. I'm really excited.
You know the weather here, so you know how envious I am of you right now. Now, when I said we're going to look at some love here, we're talking Valentine's Day already. It always sneaks up on me. And at your restaurant, you do an aphrodisiac dinner. So every year we talk about aphrodisiacs. And so how would you like to tell us a little bit about your dinner?
Well, I've always been interested in the way food affects the body and the mind and how certain foods bring back memories and just how food makes people feel good. And it just seemed very natural to do an aphrodisiac menu for Valentine's Day just in case you need that extra push for the holiday.
Now, have you done this before, or is this the first time?
This is an annual menu.
Okay.
I change it every year for the year, and I've just had a lot of fun with it, and it seems to get more and more popular every year.
Of course, if you do any research in this, everything in the world's an aphrodisiac.
It can be. I think if it's prepared right, absolutely.
You have oysters, chocolate.
I don't know about toast.
Toast.
You never know. If you're getting it in bed.
Toast is, yeah.
Then you don't have to make it.
You're right with this program, Janine.
Toast afterwards. It'd be too many crumbs otherwise. So what's on the menu?
So this year we always start out with oysters. It's a great little amuse. Obviously we're surrounded by a lot of great sparkling wine houses with Domaine Carneros and Gloria Ferrer. So I do a little drunken oyster with a Blanc de Noir mignonette, and it's a local oyster. And we start off the meal with an amuse right off the bat. And then we move into our salad, which is a hearts of palm and radish salad with avocados and vanilla vinaigrette. And, every course we highlight what the aphrodisiac
is. Yeah, what is that? That would be the avocado.
Avocado, the vanilla, and the radish.
Yeah, and radish I missed. That's an aphrodisiac for what reason?
You know what? I think it's the shape and the slight tanginess and heat of it.
Heat, right.
Hearts of palm, I just put in there as a heart, just to keep it kind of cute and festive.
That's very clever.
Yeah, it is.
Now let's peel back and say I think he said that Eileen Crane from Domaine Carneros is coming in to dinner tonight, and
she is, and
you're going to tell her hello from On the Menu Radio because
we
interviewed her a couple of years ago, and so her beverage will be absolutely perfect to start off and probably to go with the salad as well, maybe.
The salad from Eileen, I would definitely do the Brut Rosé.
Love it.
The radish and the vanilla vinaigrette is going to complement the wild strawberry notes that you get right off the bat. As soon as you smell that Brut Rosé, you get wild strawberries, which is also an aphrodisiac.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Right. All the seeds, right?
Okay, so fired up. What comes next?
Next up, we have a lobster and carrot risotto, and the aphrodisiac in that course is the carrot.
I know
and
why.
Again, it's a shape, and the beta carotene in carrots is also known to be a great stimulant, especially for men.
Yes, and actually, I might mention that oysters have zinc, which is
not only that, but you can also see better.
Yeah,
exactly.
Which would probably be a good thing. You can
never
tell.
So. Maybe not. It's easier to turn out the light you said once.
No, that was somebody else.
Now he repeated the story. I wouldn't it be fun to have a facelift? He said, a friend whose wife said the same thing, and he said it's cheaper to turn off the lights.
That was my friend Frank Robb in Australia. He was the quietest husband you can ever imagine. His wife was the loudest possible wife. And at a cocktail party once, I overheard him say this. I almost died.
Moving on. We don't want to distract you. What's next?
So next is a smoked duck confit, and I just get it nice and crispy on the outside, and then I spice sweet potato and fry it in tempura, and I spice it with a little nutmeg and chili powder.
Yeah, that's
all. And then serve it with black beans, which are, again, another aphrodisiac. So you have the chili from the spice rub, and then onions and black beans in the black beans, as well as chili. So that'll hit you three times.
That sounds really good. This sounds like a good dinner. I'm not going to eat
confit with black beans.
Next up we have entrees. And, you know, the entrees I've had a lot of fun with. I try to offer something beef and a bird of sorts, a poultry item or a game, and then a fish. So our fish offering or seafood offering is scallops with brown butter artichoke hearts, which are the aphrodisiac, and basil.
Uh-huh.
And both of those are aphrodisiacs. And then, or you could have your choice of CK lamb, which is our local lamb purveyor. It's raised by Bruce Campbell, with olive cavatelli, arugula, and pine nuts.
So you have
three aphrodisiacs in that dish. Next up, we have a coffee-crusted beef tenderloin.
This is a lot of food. How many courses?
No, well, you have your choice of entree.
This is a choice.
That's with the potato gratin. But the coffee is a stimulant, and it'll keep you awake after this dinner. Also an aphrodisiac. And then a local game hen.
I can't wait for your explanation of dessert.
We'll get there in a second. Petaluma game hen, they're raised just 10 to 13 miles away, and it's with a pancetta wrapped drumstick, and pancetta has nutmeg in it, and that becomes part of the aphrodisiac, and then a cipollini onion mousse, and the onion is an aphrodisiac.
Wow.
So right before dessert, you have a pre-dessert, and it's a pineapple soda with a little bit of spiced rum in it.
Oh.
So just in case the wine pairings haven't been enough at this point, we move right into a little rum, and hopefully that makes you think of warm beach romantic weather. And for dessert, we do a Mexican chocolate fondue.
Oh, well, that, you can't go wrong with that. You've got spice and you've got chocolate.
And it's so decadent. It's cinnamon sticks, aphrodisiac, and chilies, and then dark chocolate, and we put it with pound cake that we make here in-house, and different nuts, and strawberries, pineapple,
oh, it sounds luxurious.
Marshmallows, pretzels, and that's for two, so you have to share that with your dinner date.
Yeah.
Well, that sounds absolutely wonderful. Now, we need to get, I'm sure, close to Valentine's Day, we probably need to get a phone number as well as a website, so can we add those to the end of the recording? Go ahead.
Absolutely.
So how do people make a reservation?
You could go on opentable.com and make a reservation, or call our number at 707-931-2042.
And the website for the hotel property is?
www.thelodgeatsonoma.com.
Thelodgeatsonoma.com.
So there you are. If you're in California close by, or if you're really desperate because you haven't made plans yet and you're prepared to travel some distance.
Or you need a little help with your love life.
Now you know what to do on Valentine's Day, and it will remain a secret until afterwards where on the menu is going to be for Valentine's Day, but it's a traditional place for us.
Are we going there?
we're not going to give away that secret until afterwards.
Okay.
But we'll explain what aphrodisiacs we ate on the 14th of February, and we'll compare them to the ones that were in your menu. And thank you so much for joining us. What fun.
Janine, you sound you're having fun anyhow.
It is. You know what? I don't know if it's the Sonoma wine or what, but it is pretty fun, especially when you get to play with aphrodisiac. Hopefully make someone's night just that more special.
Maybe you should give us a little report afterwards.
I definitely, you know, we've never done a survey like the next morning to
that
see what happens.
That would be
hysterical. We are in a very romantic location.
Yeah, yes, you are.
Who would conduct the survey, for heaven's sake?
I don't think I want any part of it.
Yeah, but it is, incidentally, just one of the most beautiful small townscapes in America. If you haven't been to downtown Sonoma, right in the center in what was the Mexican Empire in California. Lots of interesting history associated with it, too. Lots of places to shop. It's a fabulous place to go, and we need to go there again soon.
Yeah, Janine, and as I said, stay in touch with us.
Absolutely.
Okay, because I'm sure we have lots more to talk about.
I definitely do.
Okay, Janine, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Happy Valentine's.
You too.
Bye-bye, dear.
Bye-bye.
Whoa, that was exhausting. Now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, helping us celebrate Valentine's Day.
We hope all your plans are going well, and if not, it's not too late to make a little candy.
Well, I mean, the king of candy, of course, is chocolate. And our next guest not only knows a whole bunch about it, he teaches it, and he's written a book about it. So let's listen to Peter Grueling. In Chocolates and Confections at Home with the Culinary Institute of America, certified master baker Peter Grueling takes the mystery out of candy making with all the advice, techniques, and user-friendly recipes you need to recreate your favorite confections at home. Now, I just read that from your book jacket, but I agree with it. I mean, I have no talent whatsoever for baking. I've never made candy in my life, and I feel as though I could actually start, once I got some supplies, making candied apples and truffles and what else do you have in here?
Well, you know, I'm sure you could do that.
Marshmallows, nougat,
sure,
jellies.
This book is designed exactly for people with some degree of enthusiasm and not necessarily a lot of experience. And it also suits people up to those who have a fair amount of experience. So, yeah, you could definitely.
So you're dealing with it at multiple levels.
Oh, definitely. The formulas, some of them are very, very basic, and some require a little bit more experience. And they're all labeled as to how much skill is probably advisable. And they're all very accessible for the home.
And don't forget, candy is dandy, but candy is not necessarily quicker, and as Ogden Nash said, but for a different reason.
That's right.
Because there's an art of patience in here, I think.
I think making candy requires some patience and requires some attention to detail, but when you enjoy it, it's very easy to do.
You know, I just see the, well, first of all, I want to ask you how you ended up doing this. Did you study culinary and then just sort of ended up?
You know, that's pretty much what happened. I started out on a culinary path, became a pastry chef after a few years, and I did that for quite a number of years, and then I started teaching here at the Culinary Institute of America, and there I developed a real interest in confections, and here I am.
Well, you know, I don't know how many people we interview who had a suit-style day job and decided to go make chocolates.
Now, were you one of those, or did you just go straight to the kitchen, Peter?
I went virtually straight to the kitchen. Yeah, pretty much. And so from there, I've really refined myself towards pastry and then towards chocolates and confections.
Now, tell us about the because I think this is a very deliberate organization to this book, very lucid. Could you explain to the listeners your divisions into, like, equipment and ingredients, chocolate, and run through the organization? outline for us?
Sure, absolutely. Well, the book is an overview of confectionery and chocolate work for home people to use. So it does start off with the essentials of equipment and ingredients and what you'll need to make the recipes in the book. And chocolate, being a fairly important part of this process, deserves a chapter of its own. And in that I discuss what chocolate is made of, and not so much about how it's made, but how it should be handled, certainly. From there, there's a chapter on master techniques, and those are fundamental techniques that are used in virtually all of the recipes in the book.
You mean like tempering and things?
Right, chocolate tempering, sugar cooking techniques, things like that.
How about that spun sugar stuff? I never did get the hang of that one.
Right, so that chapter has all the vital, really fundamental techniques for the book. And then after that are various chapters of recipes, which are broken up by category, including truffles in one chapter, brittles, toffees, and taffies in another.
Now, I'd like to make brittles. There's some wonderful recipes for brittles.
Brittles are great, especially this time of year when the air is a little bit drier. Brittles are really fantastic to make, and they're well within the reach of home confectioners.
Now, I introduce a note here of definition for listeners who are not as aware of all the branches of making sweet things. When you say confectionery, that means sweets rather than cakes and buns and things like that, correct?
Well, that's exactly right. Confectionery is sugar-based, whereas baking is more flour-based.
Okay, that's very good. Yeah, that's a very good definition.
Hey, I could make caramel corn. Oh, yums!
You could. You could make it, and then you could eat it, and then you would weigh. Then you would weigh 1,000 pounds, and you would hit yourself over the head with a book. This is a real brick, Peter. We were talking off the air about the concussion that might result from mishandling of this book.
Oh well. That's not really my intention for the book, but I suppose it could be used that way.
It's certainly a chunk. Now, is this a set text in your classes? I mean, we should remind listeners that you are a full-time instructor at the Culinary Institute of America.
Yes. This book actually is not a textbook in my class. My first book, which was geared more towards professionals.
Ah, there we are now.
That's the textbook for my class.
I knew we'd get a plug-in for another book if we worked at it.
Well, of course. This book I took a totally different approach with. I looked at this from the home confectioner's point of view, and I made sure that all of the ingredients and all of the techniques are things that are very accessible to people at home, not necessarily only to professionals.
And it's full of absolutely incredibly thoughtful tips like, by the way, be aware that candy is very difficult to get off the cooking pan. So a very smart way to start is to put plastic wrap inside the pan. What a great idea.
Yeah, I like this, the history of marshmallow. I mean, I for years thought marshmallows grew on bushes, and I didn't realize that it was really based in reality in history.
That's so funny, right? People are always surprised when they find out that marshmallows came from the marsh mallow plant.
Right.
And not exactly growing on them, but from the sap of the root.
Oh, okay, so it's based on a tree, but it's not based on the fruit of a tree.
Yeah, no, but I kept envisioning having a little white fluffy thing growing on a bush.
Right. Well, you probably don't remember this, so I'm sure somebody did a similar thing on the Tonight Show or something like that, probably 50 years ago or 55 years ago, the BBC news program, which is sort of like 60 Minutes, called Panorama, they did an April 1st broadcast all about spaghetti trees.
Oh, very nice.
And they had real-life trees with spaghetti growing out of the end of the end of the branches.
Well, that's nothing compared to the marshmallow harvest.
Well, that's what Anne said. She thought that's where they all came from.
Well, do the homemade ones taste any better?
Absolutely they do.
I mean, they have to.
And the reason is because in the manufactured marshmallows, they're using mostly imitation flavors. And in homemade marshmallows, you can use beautiful vanilla extract, you can use some honey, and you can put other spices in them and do things like peppermint marshmallows or spice marshmallows, which are fantastic in hot chocolate, by the way.
Oh, that sounds good, yeah. Cinnamon, yeah, would be good.
Yeah.
Now, a question about fondant. Okay. Now, we interviewed Rose Levy Berenbaum.
Yeah.
And she said a little known fact was that she actually invented chocolate fondant. Is that true?
Well, I would not want to be disrespectful towards her, and so I think I should clarify exactly what we're talking about.
Okay.
I believe when you spoke to her, she was talking about what is a little more accurately called rolled fondant or rolling fondant.
Okay.
And that is an icing to go over the outside of a cake that you actually take and you roll a sheet of it out and you put it over the outside of a cake.
Right, and you can eat it.
And I'm sure
stuff
that
gets...
Yes, and I'm sure that that's what she was talking about. So I wouldn't be able to, I certainly wouldn't disagree with her there. However, that's not what actual fondant is.
Uh-huh.
Actual fondant is a matter of cooking sugar, usually with some corn syrup, and allowing it to cool slightly, and then agitating it until it actually crystallizes and turns into this white, sort of plasticky mixture. And so that's what real fondant is, and that's what's used to do things like glazed Napoleons and glazed eclairs.
Oh.
But it also is used as a center in confectionery, and that's what mint fondants, for instance, like peppermint patties are made of.
Oh.
Okay, so as far
but
as you're... So fondant is really a technique, and...
No, it's the substance. It's the crystallized sugar mixture.
Okay.
The stuff that we get... from Peter's English, I mean my Peter, their birthday cakes and wedding cakes are all those fruit cakes with this white stuff on the outside.
Right.
Well,
you can't bite.
Yeah, they're fruit cakes. they're fruit cakes with marzipan, a thin layer of marzipan on the outside and a thicker layer on top.
That's right, but that layer is actually royal icing, which is slightly different still.
It's it's a very hard icing.
That's right. That's exactly right.
And I think it's probably intended to help preserve the cake.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, those cakes are about preservation.
Yeah, I mean, they send them through the mail.
Absolutely.
This is not a technique that would catch on these days, I think, in these days of the internet, that you put pieces of a wedding cake in small boxes and send them to all the guests who weren't present.
Right.
We got some sent by slow snail mail across the Atlantic.
It was really
and
good.
It wasn't very good when it arrived, but the tradition is...
Chewed up.
The tradition
well, right, and they're often made months ahead, aren't they?
I don't think it's that so much, but the bride and groom, the tradition for the bride and groom is if it's a tiered cake, they keep the top small tier.
Right.
And they eat that on the first wedding anniversary.
Right.
And it's not recorded what they drink with it or what they do in addition to that. I'm sure there are additional customs. But it's hard to imagine that a cake would really last very well that long, so it probably needs all the hard icing it can get.
All the hard icing and liquor it can get.
Yes.
Right.
Now,
right.
What's a ting? I've never heard of a ting.
Well, that's an Americanization of and it's a very nice little chocolate. In France, they're called mendiant. And,
oh, I know them.
Okay, so, and in Switzerland, they call them knackerli. And I called them that sort of out of half of a joke and half respect for a German pastry chef I used to work with. And his English wasn't so good, and I was very young at the time, and he would get excited, and he would need me to get something for me, and he'd forget the word for it, and he'd go, go get me ting. And I was supposed to know what it meant, and I wanted to give them an Americanized name, and so I did that sort of out of respect.
Well, Anne's mother always called things doofers.
Right.
No, that was your mother.
Oh, was it my mother?
It was your mother.
What did your mother? She had a similar similar expression for things that she couldn't remember the name of.
Now tell me this: do you have a sweet tooth?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. I have to admit, I really like sugar. I really like hard candy, which is, you know, not the most upscale thing in the world, but I really like it. And I also really like good chocolate. And not a lot of it, but a little bit every day I really like.
Yeah. And what about all these Asian candies now that's so hot?
I'm sorry, what about?
Those hard candies from Asia that's so hot.
Oh, yeah.
What are they?
You can do beautiful work with hard candy. Anything really that can be done with glass can be done with hard candy, and you can see some really beautiful handmade, extraordinary hard candies.
And you can make some of these out of the book, Peter?
Well, that's not so much the type of thing that's addressed in this book. I mean, okay. I do have hard candy recipes in there, and hard candy people can make, and it's great. It's really great. But this isn't going to turn you into a master of sugar work. Uh-huh. But you can get started here, no doubt.
And I saw the recipe you have for gianduja.
Gianduja, yes.
Gianduja, yeah. And that's Italian.
That's a tough word to get out.
That's right. It's Italian, and it's traditionally a mixture of chocolate with hazelnuts. And the hazelnuts are ground so finely that there's no texture, so it's a very smooth mixture. And it has a really beautiful aroma of hazelnuts, and it melts in your mouth very, very quickly, and it's really delicious stuff.
Yeah, I think I could fall in love with those.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Now, one thing I've never understood, and you have a lot of these jellies. Now, Peter likes these jellies, don't you?
Well, we used to be called fruit pastilles.
Right.
So we got in England.
Right.
And some of them were really good. They were jelly-like. And then there were other ones that were like gumdrops, which you had to chew, which I didn't like.
Right.
So you make those jelly kinds of things.
That's right. That's exactly right. What I've mostly done in this book are pectin jellies. So they're very much like jelly. They're a little firmer than jellies that you would spread on a bread, of course. So they'll hold their shape, but they're really fresh tasting and they're beautiful. They're fruit puree with sugar and then just enough pectin added to them, and they really have a great texture to them. Also,
this is exactly these fruit things you're describing are exactly what we used to eat as candy in England. We also used to eat a thing called Turkish Delight,
mm-hmm.
which you probably know of as well.
I not only know of it, I have a recipe
for it in the book,
as a matter of fact.
Yeah, well, I won't make that because if I did that and then put chocolate on it, I would automatically gain 50 pounds because I'd eat all of it.
Yeah.
Really?
Well, it would take me back to my childhood. And
he's
that's
skinny.
That's great.
Sure.
You know,
Peter, he's very skinny. He has this huge metabolism. He can eat anything and not put on a pound.
Well, Peter Grueling's probably pretty tall.
He is thin.
He's tall and thin too.
He is tall and thin.
Well, I chose my parents carefully. You know,
that's what it is about. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now there, I think this is just wonderful. Turtles. I mean, you could go nuts with this stuff. What do you think you enjoy making the most? Not eating, but making.
Oh, let's see. Well, I really enjoy making the nougats.
Oh, really?
Like the nougat tarroni.
Oh, really? Why?
They're a little challenging to make beautifully. Certainly not impossible, certainly not beyond the scope of what people can fairly easily do. But, you know, it takes some attention to detail, and I like that. And there's something very satisfying about them to me. It's so beautiful.
And for a real beginner, for a real rookie...
And where for a real beginner...
Where would be a good place to start?
You know, I would probably start with either a fudge or maybe a praline.
Yeah, I don't get pralines either.
So they're pretty straightforward. My nephews and nieces and their children all absolutely love fudge.
Right. But, you know, also what I think is that people shouldn't be afraid of chocolate and working with it. And so in this book, what I've done is I've recorded a pretty simple technique that people can use to temper chocolate. And it's not so difficult at all. And I would encourage everybody, even though people are sometimes a little scared of that, I would encourage everybody just to get some chocolate and melt it carefully and to follow the steps and to go ahead and temper it and then dip some things in it. It's great.
Well, I think this is a wonderful contribution, Peter. It's so good of you to step out of the classroom and prepare a cookbook for the rest of us who can't attend the CIA. And for taking a lot of the mystery out and coming along with a whole set of tips that will make sure that you have a better chance to be successful making sweets for the sweet or candy for the dandy or whatever you like.
Well, it's certainly my pleasure to do that. It's a beautiful book, I think.
Oh, it is, Peter. The photographs are just gorgeous.
It is, it is, of course, available through www.onthemenuradio and OTM Bookshelf and at fine booksellers all over the place. And if you drop by the CIA, I'll bet you could even get an autographed copy.
Peter, I'll bet that could easily be arranged.
Peter, thank you so much for joining us on the menu. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Peter.
Okay.
Bye. And now it's time to take another break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Remember, it's Valentine's Day, so reach out and touch somebody, and do reach out and keep in touch with us, too.
And you can do that, of course, by clicking on our homepage with your social network or your email of choice. We love to hear from you, and we especially would love to hear from you if you celebrated Valentine's Day in a particularly special way that might be of interest to our audience, or perhaps it just might be of interest to us, because we're always looking for suggestions and ideas. And suggestions and ideas about how food and life go together are reflected in a very interesting book that crossed our path.
Well, this interview has been so long in a queue that they may have gotten divorced by now.
we don't think so. And I bet they're celebrating Valentine's Day in style because they talk about their marriage in gastronomy as well as their marriage in person, and it's really a fascinating tale.
Michelle Maisto, welcome to On the Menu. I used the term discussing with you called, the book is entitled The Gastronomy of Marriage, a memoir of food and love. I used the term metaphor, that food was in fact a metaphor for the coming together of two distinct personalities in a wedding, and you seem to think that was a good enough description. And then I also think that it might be a parable. What do you think about that?
Oh, that's interesting. Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's jump right into this book. Tell us about this book.
I do think it's a bit of a metaphor. I think dinner at least was a microcosm of marriage. It was this small example of all the things, all the ways you have to compromise and sort of finding yourself and the things that are wonderful and the things that are frustrating to marriage. It gave me a way to sort of wrap my head around marriage and the idea of getting married and what I was committing myself to. And so I've told all these stories of us sitting down to the table each night, which, are a metaphor, I guess, for all of our food issues are a metaphor for the greater marriage.
And it's a parable about how you actually could make it work, huh?
I hope so. We're 4.5 years in now, and you've said that you're 36 years in. So as far as making it work, I think you've figured it out. But it's my best shot so far.
And everything seems to be going well?
It's wonderful. Thank you.
Trigger on the back cover, it says, all of a sudden Rich got to do more work, so you had to step up and do more in the kitchen. Now, there's something about that I don't quite understand.
So I mean,
why weren't you doing more in the kitchen to begin with?
That's very clever.
I'm very sneaky.
Well, let's get a little background here. First of all, now, you are of Italian heritage?
That's right, and Rich is Chinese.
And Rich is, you're both American-born?
Right.
But you had two totally different culinary traditions.
Exactly. So my dad is from southern Italy, and all four of my grandparents are from there as well, and his parents are from China. So we not only had sort of an interracial marriage, but a sort of inter-dietary marriage that I didn't eat meat and he did. So
the other one. I remember there was another factor, yeah.
You're probably still fighting over whether or not Marco Polo took spaghetti to China or the other way around, or brought noodles back.
That is still under dispute, I think.
It's still under discussion, too.
We had a sort of a lot to compromise at the table, and then there's even things like I can't eat a whole bowl of carbs every night. I'd have to be running for miles and miles and miles, and he blows through the calories, and his stomach is more sensitive than mine. So there's just all these things that once you're in a home, which is I think such a place of comfort, and maybe all the ways we compromise out in the real world, we want to fall away when we're at home. We want to be completely comfortable and get whatever we want. So we're sort of doing this dance around each other, trying to figure out how to each be ourselves and have our own needs met and be together. But
now, you were foodies as well? You were both foodies in different ways?
Yeah, absolutely. Food was such a big part of our courtship and all the fun we'd have together. One of our first trips, international trips, was we went to Switzerland, and I remember so well Rich walking me to the grocery store with some ceremony, and we turned the aisle into the cold section, and him saying, "This is Swiss dairy," and it was all these this whole like glowing wall of all of these beautiful yogurts from goats and sheep and cows, and with little pots with fruits and grains and all these beautiful things, and we bought a bunch of yogurts and good cheeses and bread, and he got some prosciutto, and we sat on the curb and had this like wonderful impromptu lunch from the grocery store, which maybe a lot of people would have rather to walk to a nice restaurant, but we couldn't have been more thrilled. It really stands out in my mind. So here was this person who I had such a good food experience with, and then moving in together every night, we began having this tug of war. What do you want to eat? What do you want to eat?
Oh, okay. So it started out with some conflict.
Yeah, well, we did all right for the first few weeks. I think we were really showing off to each other how modern we were. We were each taking turns doing the cooking. And then eventually we realized, okay, we really have to plan this wedding, and that was when then the money comes into play, and so Rich said, okay, I've paid for this, I'll take on more assignments. He was a freelance writer, and so to sort of, you know, want to be part of the team and contribute, I thought, okay, well, I can do your half of the housework to contribute. And just like that, I think we'd put ourselves in this very traditional
But you insisted that it had to be temporary, right?
Yes. Very insistent it was temporary.
And was it?
I still do most of the cooking, but I think part of what I learned in the end is, and I really do enjoy being in the kitchen. I love cooking. I love cooking for him. My mom definitely loved us with food. It was definitely a way that she showed us she cared. And so it was fun for me also to like bake Rich's favorite desserts and things like that. So yes, now I still do a lot of the cooking, but I've realized it's not the gauge of our relationship, or it doesn't show who's more powerful, or it doesn't dictate the power dynamic in our relationship, which I think it really scared me in the beginning to think that's what it did.
So you've written this wonderful book. Now, what do you do next? Is this going to be a prime-time soap opera kind of television series, sort of like Food Meets Sex in the City?
That would be hysterical. No, there's no plans.
That would be hysterical.
feel free to spread that rumor around. No, I guess I'm working on a blog that's going about going to the farmers markets, and we eat a lot from the farmers markets these days, and I think that helps to dictate what we eat. So hopefully if I can spin something off of that, because I'm so interested in it, I think it's so important too to be more aware of where our food is coming from and to put a face on it.
Yeah, well, we believe in the same thing, so we bought rabbits on Saturday, and we bought liver, which we cooked last night,
right?
And it was very good, and I'm sure it was very good because I cooked it.
It's still in the freezer.
One of the rabbits has cut up the other's whole. I understand. I don't really quite.
Yeah, one's whole and one's cut up.
I don't really quite know what I'm going to do
with it. Because that's how the Pam had. Well, I told you what we're going to do with them. We're going to cook them like my mother cooks.
You mean I'm going to cook them like your mother used to cook them? You're going to have to give me instructions.
Peter's English. He was raised in the UK.
Yeah, but we sure didn't eat things like rabbits.
You had jugged hare.
Oh, yeah, we had jugged hare.
Well, it's rotten meat.
Well, Cambridge was different. The food was rotten there, too, but it was rotten for different reasons.
But you also grew up with different culinary traditions.
Exactly.
I grew up with no culinary tradition whatsoever. I mean, I'd be the first to admit that. And what's happened in the last several years is Anne and Peter have been on something of a mission to dispel the idea that British food is still terrible, because it's really not. There's some of the best cooking in the world going on, especially in the restaurant scene in cities like London.
But not in your mother's household. But that was really bad.
The one thing in my mother's household you could be sure of was everything was dead, really dead. And I made the mistake once. I remind myself of it regularly, because we love Brussels sprouts, and you can get the most beautiful Brussels sprouts in England around Christmas time, because it's the season of the year they grow, and they grow just right. They're made for the weather with a little bit of frost. So I bought 2 or 3 pounds of these wonderful Brussels sprouts, and then I forgot to take charge of cooking them.
Uh-oh.
And my mother turned them into green mush. And I was so sad. But maybe Rich has turned things into green mush or red mush or brown mush over the years. Or perhaps you've done that too.
Yes, we've definitely had to suffer through each other's disasters. But I think that's such a good example of how, I think what we grow up with, in certain situations, I think we think that's the right way, or that's the way our family does it the right way. So when you're living with somebody else who comes from a different tradition, it's sort of a little uncomfortable that they think they know the right way and you think you know the right way. So I think that applied at the table, and then also in marriage in general and in our relationship, I had to learn to relax what I had learned at home or learned from other people and sort of come around to what honestly worked for the two of us.
Now, did you know you were going to write this book, or did you take notes for it? You seem to have incredibly detailed recall of things that happened.
I did. I started, after we sort of started having this difficult time, and it was upsetting that the thing that had been such a good thing for us was the main source of friction. So I started writing down basically just for myself what we were eating for dinner every night. That I was an anthropology major in college as well as an English major, and I loved that from everyday data you could find meaning. And so
I had this
idea that if I could see a list of what we'd eaten over the course of a few months, maybe this would say something interesting. I had started writing it down.
Okay, so when did the idea come along to make it into a book?
I'd always written essays. That's the format I'm most comfortable in. And I'd written it up as an essay. And basically, I found an agent who I had put together a collection of essays who was very interested in the collection, and there was only one essay that didn't have food in it, and he said, do you have anything else that we can put here instead? And I said, well, I am working on this other thing. And then once he read that essay, he said, oh, this should be a whole book. So then I really started writing down even more intently what we were eating.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so what comes next?
Yeah, I was going to ask the same question.
What comes next?
Oh, gosh, I don't know.
Another book, another adventure?
Hopefully both, yeah. I'd love to do something talking more. And we really, so that was 2005 that the book took place, and we really do eat a bit differently now. It is more seasonal, paying attention to genetically modified foods and trying not to eat those, and shopping in the farmer's market. So hopefully something more along those lines, just helping people be more thoughtful about the decisions they make at the table.
And you also have a blog, you said.
I do. It's called themarketreport.net, and there are 45 farmers markets in New York, so I try. And normally you only see the one in your neighborhood, so I think it's kind of fun to go to all the different ones and let people see what they look like and also just say what's in season, what's coming, what's going, and just that idea of it's so exciting to eat strawberries when they just come into season versus having strawberries all year long. Being mindful that they shouldn't be around all year long.
Yeah, they don't grow on trees, right? In fact,
right.
They actually don't grow on trees, they grow on plants. Well, please give our kindest regards to Richard, whose life has been awfully exposed as a result of his book. It's a good job you don't have a picture of him on the back cover, otherwise his life would be over.
And the book, again, is called The Gastronomy of Marriage, and the author is Michelle Maisto, and I look forward to your next book, and your blog, again, is called
TheMarketReport.net.
TheMarketReport.net.
And we just know there's going to be a sequel, we just don't know what it's going to be called yet.
Yes, we'll see.
Well, yeah, probably a compilation of blogs. Everybody's blogging about food these days, you know.
Michelle, thank you so much for joining us. And once again, please give our very fondest regards
to
your super tolerant, task-sharing husband.
It's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Michelle, thank you. And good luck, huh?
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And we'll be right back after we take another break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Perhaps you knew, perhaps you didn't know, that many fruits are considered aphrodisiacs.
Right.
And one surprised me, to tell you the truth. I guess a grapefruit doesn't seem particularly aphrodisiacal, but apparently it certainly is.
Yeah, and this is also about passion, because our next guest has a passion for Florida, so it's a passion for place, a passion for food, because she's a food writer and editor, and also a passion for this little grapefruit tree in her backyard in Florida that inspired all these wonderful recipes in her book, which is called Delicious Grapefruit Recipes.
Wrapping up the program, what would be considered the original aphrodisiac?
The very first
aphrodisiac of all time, of course, the apple, which Eve picked from the tree and gave to Adam. In this case, we're picking a very new kind of apple from a fruit tree in the state of Washington, an apple variety called piñata. And when you listen to this interview, you'll know a lot more about piñata apples, and perhaps you'll have an apple. Perhaps you'll give an apple to the one you love, and the consequences won't be so bad as they were in the Garden of Eden. Anyway, it seems like a great way to finish up the program, and we hope you've had a wonderful day with us.
And well, you know, they think that the apple from the garden, the forbidden apple, was really a pomegranate.
It was really, well, regardless, in that case, it's a piñata apple, and that's all there is to it.
Your publisher, Patricia Mack, writes on the back of your latest book, Food Editor Extraordinaire. And I think that that's a pretty accurate description. You really do have a knack for editing. But you're also a writer, and is this your first book that you wrote?
No, this is actually my fourth cookbook, my sixth book. I did two travel books about Florida last year for Fox Network News over in Tampa.
Uh-huh, I'm great.
Yeah, it was really fun, and I just love Florida, even though it's not my native state. It's a wonderful state, and endlessly fascinated by it.
Well, now, you live in New Jersey, but you've been going to Florida for how many years?
ever since childhood, really.
Now, you don't have to tell us how many years that was. That must be at least five.
Yes, that's right. How very smart of you. 100 years is more like it. Ever since, oh gosh, it has to go back to the 50s.
Now you said your father introduced you to...
My dad loved Florida, and vacationing in Florida was always a really big deal, and we looked forward to it all year. And of course, this was before there were super highways, and we would go through so many little towns and little highways. It wasn't easy to get to Florida in those days. And then when he retired, he bought a retirement home, and I have it now. He gave it to me. He doesn't get to come down here as much anymore, so...
Uh-huh.
No, but I just love it. It's filled with memories, and I'm really happy here.
Oh, that's great. And you tell us how the genesis of this book is called Delicious Grapefruit Recipes. And
right. Well,
it's part of a series. Would you explain this?
It's part of a series called Famous Florida. And there are several installments, key lime and orange and all the citruses that grow so beautifully in Florida. And it is everything except grapefruit. And I've known the publisher of Seaside Publishing for a long time, and we were chatting, and I suggested that the one missing key here was grapefruit, and I just happened to be a great grapefruit cook.
Yeah,
thanks to a little grapefruit tree in my backyard that I've had for years, and it's just been a joy. And she said, perfect, write it. So that's what I did, and I culled through all of my own personal files, and we also added some from Florida chefs, and we did some research also into the history of cooking. We found contest winners and citrus contests around the state and came up with a collection of really wonderful grapefruit recipes.
Yeah, I mean, who knew?
I know. Well, that's what people say now, because grapefruit is not as popular as it once was, I don't think. It's considered just something for breakfast for people who like it. But when we did the research through old cookbooks in Florida, newspapers, in the 30s and 40s, grapefruits were used in every part of the meal for desserts and sauces and entrees and salads. So it really is a very versatile fruit, and not just something to be sprinkled with sugar and broiled, although you can do that. A lot of recipes, variations on that. That's the classic. But it's
we used to put salt in ours.
Well, what do you put?
My family used to put salt on.
Salt, huh?
Yeah.
Some people put rum and broil it with rum on it.
Not for breakfast. I'm talking about breakfast.
Not for breakfast, well.
Well, some of these recipes are, you have candy grapefruit peel.
Yes, that's an old classic. That's a great recipe, and I just love that. I love orange peel candied. It's a lot of work, but it's worth the effort, because you have to scrape away all of that bitter pith, and then when you have the strips, you have to boil it for several times and change the water to get all that really bitter, bitter taste out. And then you dry it, you put it in sugar, you dry it, and then you roll it in sugar. Sometimes you can even dip it in chocolate then, and it's absolutely delicious.
And one of the most startling things for me, Pat, is the way that you use grapefruit juice as a marinade and as a flavoring in chickens and meat recipes, which is something that would not have occurred to me to do with grapefruit. And obviously, you realize that there are roots going back, that in fact this is probably done before people were using orange juice and lemon juice to do a similar thing.
Didn't you ever?
I think so.
Didn't you ever taste my salmon, rabbit? I marinated in pink grapefruit juice.
It's so long ago, I don't remember.
Well, salmon. I actually, the last time I did it was at our granddaughter's baptism, if you remember.
I honestly don't remember.
Yeah, but anyhow, I'm really sympathetic with this. I mean, I'm right with you on this. Pat, tell us where you are in Florida.
I'm in Cocoa, Florida. It's there's Cocoa, and then there's Cocoa Beach.
They're
two separate communities, closely related, of course, and it's on the east coast of Florida, not far from the Kennedy Space Center. We can see the space shots from our backyard, which is a nice advantage.
Yeah, we went there once.
We stayed at that hotel.
In fact, we stayed at a hotel near Cocoa Beach because the boys, we took Adam and a friend of his, David, to Florida, and we made a stop, and we went to, I think it was still called Cape Canaveral then.
Uh-huh.
And you could see the launch vehicles, and they were, of course, fascinated by all of that stuff. And
it's
then,
still fascinating, yeah.
And that's on the Beeline Highway, right? Just
that's
off the Beeline Highway?
It used to be the Beeline, but now they have changed it because the Cocoa Beach is the closest beach to Disney. So Disney, I guess their influence, they changed the name of the Beeline to the Beach Line. So it is now Beach Line that brings you to Cocoa. So
no, it was always... It was almost so much fun to be called the Beeline Highway, and the reason was...
I know. They have little bees on the sign to have your but now it's Beach Line.
But it was called Beeline because you made a beeline for something because it was a straight road. I mean,
the name
had some meaning, and at least it did to me.
So what is the restaurant scene like in that section, Pat? I imagine... Go ahead.
It's very much... kind of barefoot cuisine, I like to call it. A lot of beachfront restaurants where you get really simple food, the kind of pub food that everybody loves, chicken wings and burgers, and a lot of verandas overlooking the ocean, and people coming off the beach in their bathing suits. There's music. And
see, that's fun.
It really is fun, really and truly. And there's a lot of waterways here. There's in between where I am in Cocoa and the ocean, the Atlantic Ocean, there's the Banana River, and there's the Indian River. And so there are a lot of restaurants along rivers also, and you can have lunch and watch bottlenose dolphins and the seagulls. And
When are you going to write a book about birds? Because you're a big bird watcher, right?
That's my passion. I just love to watch birds. And it started because I didn't think I got many birds in my New Jersey backyard. All I remembered seeing were robins and wrens, and a bird watcher said, just put some seed out and just keep track of how many were there. And for a long time, I counted 15 different varieties of birds.
Wow.
And I got hooked. And coming to Florida, there are so many exotic birds that I just love it. And I started photographing them, and then I got really serious about it and started taking classes. And I just love going to all the nature centers. And it means sitting for hours in the marshland sometimes. Not very comfortable, but you come away with some of the most beautiful, beautiful bird shots.
But so you don't catch them and cook them with grapefruit juice.
No, I do not.
Oh dear!
That's just reserved for chickens and rock corn chains.
That's right.
Well, I'll ask you my famous question. I ask everybody: do you know what birds talk about?
No, what do birds talk about?
I do know a little bit more about that now. But I called the National Aviary once, and I seriously wanted to know because you know what they sound like, and they sound like they're different different species of birds, and they're all.
Mm-hmm.
Have their own calls, and
right.
They'd wake me up in the morning with all the chatter. So I called the National Aviary, and I said, I'd like some information, please. And she said, what is it? And I said, I want to know what birds talk about. And she put me on hold and never came back.
I get that. And why?
Yeah, she put you on hold and then connected you with the crazy line where...
Oh, dear. Well, listen, Pat, how about giving this series another plug and your book, which is Delicious Grapefruit Recipes, and it's a charming series. I mean, it's just key lime cooking and famous recipes from famous places.
Right. We tried to keep it very simple for the modern cook. There's not a lot of ingredients and everything. It's pretty streamlined so that it can be done fairly quickly and pretty much guaranteed good results. So
I like these the easy breezy Florida cooking one with the cute flamingos on the cover wearing chef's hat.
Adorable. I edited that book. It's Joy and Jack Harris did that. Joy did the cooking, and her recipes are absolutely wonderful. They're inventive, they're so clever, and they're so easy. I just want to make every single recipe. It's hard to edit it because I wanted to go back in the kitchen and cook whatever I was thinking about.
Well, I think that this is a very charming series, and I was very pleased to see your book. So, listeners, get cooking with grapefruit. You have no idea the possibilities of it. Thanks for coming on the menu, Pat.
wonderful talking to you. Come to Florida.
We are doing.
Okay.
So thank you. We seem to encounter a lot of things about breeding of fruit. We're going to get another new apple, talking to Brianna Brew. Welcome to On the Menu, Brianna.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Now, you're representing Stemilt. Stemilt, is I got that right? Family
yep.
Farm?
Stemilt Growers.
Growers.
A family-owned company based in Washington State.
Right. And first of all, why do people want to have new apples? Our farm stand had 19 varieties last fall.
Well, that's a good question. People have are starting to develop a flavor for different apples, and somebody might like a tart apple, somebody might like a sweet apple, but somebody might want a combination of the two as well, and so that's why a lot of fruit growers are coming out with new apples. It also helps on the growing side of it to come up with strains of apple trees that can withstand certain conditions, growing conditions or diseases, things like that, that make it more resistant and better quality.
Now, there's a real big apple growing tradition in the state of Washington, right?
Right.
And how did that begin?
How did that begin? That's a good question that I actually don't know the answer to exactly, but I do know that Washington's climate is the real reason why we're able to produce such high quality apples. Eastern Washington specifically has an arid climate where lots of warm, sunny days during the summer, very little rain, which apples don't like, and basically ideal conditions that produce large, crisp fruit.
Okay, now what were some of the traditional varieties that are grown?
Traditional varieties would be your Red Delicious, Gold Delicious, Granny Smith would be your main three, and those are still grown in Washington. It's just that a lot of new varieties like Pinata, the one we're going to talk about, Gala, Honeycrisp, Sweet Tango, these new varieties are coming out because of consumer preference for different flavors.
Well, you know, I don't want to be picky, but Gala is a very old heritage apple.
Oh, okay, right, from New Zealand.
So, but it's a wonderful apple, too. It's, mm-hmm. it's starting to come back in favor, as a lot of the old varieties are. But we do have new ones. And tell us, Pinata is a bred from what and what?
Pinata is actually three different varieties crossed together. It's Golden Delicious, and then Cox's Orange Pippin, and Duchess of Oldenburg. And those latter two are heirloom varieties from Europe. Duchess of Oldenburg, I believe, is from Russia. Cox's Orange Pippin is from England. And the apple was bred in the 1970s and then released throughout Europe in 1986. Bred in Dresden Pillnitz, Germany at their apple breeding program. And just like Sweet Tango, it takes many, many years to cultivate an apple. And Pinata is basically the result of those three crosses.
Now, how did your company find, is there a sort of a world mafia of apple growers who knows everything about apples?
Well, Smil was out on kind of on the lookout for a club variety, a variety to call their own. It happened to be that Pinata was named Apple of the Year in Germany in 2001 under its former name, Pinova.
Pinova.
Right, under the cultivar name.
Yeah, I just wondered why a German apple in the United States was called Pinata.
Yeah, nope, that was Stemilt that renamed.
So it's not a Mexican apple, it's a Washington State apple.
It is. Pinata just combines its exciting attributes.
What makes Pinata special?
Well, Pinata is special for several reasons. First of all, it's one of the best fresh-eating apples I've ever had, and I'm sure many people would agree.
And really juicy.
We would say the same. You sent us a couple of samples, and we thought they were absolutely delicious.
Yeah, and then it also appeals to chefs and home cooks. We found that in working with a chef from Seattle, Washington, Jason Wilson, he's the owner of Crush, he kind of found the apple and contacted us and was like, you know, how can I get my hands on these? I want to work with them. And he's done some amazing things with this apple. Just
like what?
He made it into apple risotto, used the apples to make a risotto dish, which I've actually been able to experience, and it's just amazing. He uses different techniques with the apples. He's made it into a apple liqueur, pressed the apples, just found all these ways to use it that no one would have really ever thought of. And the reasoning behind Pinata's ability to withstand all these different methods of cook is because of Golden Delicious. That thin skin of Golden Delicious helps the apple hold its shape during baking and really just keeps the flavors intact, what a chef looks for in an apple, as well as somebody when they want to take it home and make a pie or a applesauce. Yeah.
Now, the press information said that it didn't brown when cut. And,
yeah.
Well, it did brown, but it didn't brown as much as other apples brown when you cut them. But you can't say it doesn't brown at all. You can tell the cut surface. But it does. Why is that, that it doesn't turn brown as much as the other apples?
Just within its characteristics, again, probably the Golden Delicious background of the apple just helps it withstand the browning. That makes it a good option for salads like
right.
that, whereas you cut into open to another kind of variety and it just starts to brown really quickly.
Right.
Definitely without use of something, some kind of vitamin C, you're not going to be able to have the apple not brown whatsoever.
Now, here we are talking about this wonderful apple. Now, where are people going to be able to get pinatas?
Well, pinata can be found on a national basis right now through
about
the 1st of April, both grown organically and conventionally, mostly in most major markets, large supermarkets, and some unique specialty retailers are carrying it.
Now, how people can go to find where they might see them, or they do just have to take a chance and see if they're in the store?
Well, they could take a chance, see if they're in the store, or call ahead, or we actually have a Facebook page for the apple, www.facebook.com/pinataapple.
Oh, it's got its own Facebook page.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And its own fan club?
It's a fan club. So if they want it, and we've had a lot of people contact us on that page, ask, I live here, where can I find them? And then, of course, if people are not on Facebook, our website, stamilt.com, has a inquiry page where they can contact us.
Great, nice. Now, spell that website name.
Oh, yes. www.stamilt.com.
Well, that's great. Now, I guess people are going to have a little trouble finding it. It's like the Sweet Tango. I've never seen it in a Pittsburgh market at all.
Yeah.
It's a matter of supply and demand, and the demand is high and the supply is small, right?
Exactly. And, you know, more and more pinata apples are coming into production every year. We expect 500 acres in the ground and expect many more, both conventionally and organic pinatas, to come out in the coming years.
Well, we thank you so much for telling us this fascinating story. An apple for the teacher just doesn't really quite equate, does it, to all this wonderful stuff that's going on.
What is the total number of apples in the world? If our greengrocer can sell 19 varieties in Aspinwall, Pennsylvania. I mean,
yeah, some people would claim that every apple that you pick is a different variety because it's a different strain of cultivar, but most things I've read would say there's about 7,500 varieties grown in the known varieties in the world.
Wow.
But only about 100 produced on a commercial basis.
I see.
If you want an apple treat, look out for a pinata in your local produce supplier or supermarket.
It's really pretty because you can see the gold in it too with the red blush. I mean, it's a very pretty apple.
The main thing about it is that it tastes really good.
Yeah, it is good.
And it cooks up really good, and we thank you so much for joining
Brianna,
us to talk about it.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Really
bye-bye.
So, listeners, there you have it. We hope you had a wonderful Valentine's Day, or you're about to have the rest of a wonderful Valentine's Day, whatever it works out to be. We hope you enjoyed sharing your day with us, and the program will give you some ideas if you didn't have enough already. And now, until same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.